So how was that, going and walking and being normal and being present and aware and mindful consistently? Yes? Even simple. You've had hours and hours and hours of being present. Maybe not quite so present. It's tricky, yeah? So one thing that can show you is that we really do need to stand still. We really do need to take significant moments when we can settle down. We do really need to stop. We do need to go and be by ourselves sometimes to be able to support it, because it's fragile. Yeah. And it's not personal, it's just, and it's the conditions. So we need to support the conditions that help being present. So we need to take time where we're really in our bodies, where we're really in our energy bodies, where we are not, bombarded by stimulus all the time. You know, we need to take periods of not stimulated, time out. It's not healthy modern life with all of this, you know, every moment crammed with another piece of entertainment, another piece of something to do. So, okay, I'm going to take just a few minutes, any few last questions, a little Q&A. What can I help you with before we are apart? Maybe forever. You never know. Really? Please. Your name? Your name?
Jennifer.
Yes.
And he was very, very adamant that this was
not
going to, going to send everybody into karmic,
Really?
And it was kind of, he already alluded to certain things about throwing out the baby with the bathwater with, sort of the Western Buddhism. But I know he comes from the same tradition, like Ajahn Chah.
Yep. Yes.
Your people.
Yes.
So I'm just curious.
What I would say about that.
Yeah.
So I'll repeat just because I expect some people didn't hear. So Jennifer was asking about that, I don't know when, but not that long ago.
Yeah.
In the fall, Ajahn Tanisaro, Tanjeff he's known as, was here. And during the time he was here, there was a conversation. And in that conversation, not just the discussion of dying and death, but medical assistance in dying made. Because of the law being changed around in Canada. And so his response being one of that's so not what the teachings of the Buddha are, and his concerns of that becoming, problematic for people's karmic futures and so on. And so Jennifer's saying, being from the similar tradition, what do I have to say about that? Well, first, Tanjeff, a huge bow of respect. And he has been a dedicated practitioner and a brilliant scholar for so decades. So, we're all going to have our opinions. So he has his scholarly training and his interpretation of the teachings, because he's done a lot of interpreting, a lot of translating, a lot of writing, interpreting. And that's a tricky role to take, just because the teachings were from so long ago and they've been already translated so many times, and who knows what spin was being put in, and each time it's translated. So it's a tricky role that he has. I'm no scholar, so I can only base my response on my own, where I feel. So I can't be theoretical or academic. And when I think of it in terms of dharmic practice as a practitioner and being responsible, making choices which are responsible, about non-suffering, about liberation from the ego, liberation from reactivity, from fear, my response is the opposite. My response is that I'm welcoming medical assistance in dying. I was a midwife. I actually really believe in our own fate. I believe it's our bodies, it's our, as a woman, our woman's choices around pregnancy and birth and all of that. I don't see it any differently. It's also my responsibility about my own dying process. And if I'm choosing this, I support that choice. I think freedom to choose is our part of our heritage as being free humans. As far as the teachings of the Buddha and karmic conditionings, I mean, we don't even know for sure about reincarnation and what all happens. That's a huge, fascinating area. You know, if there is reincarnation, I don't know if I would be reborn as a human. My concern is that it would be linear and I'd have to come back when the planet's burning up. Like, if I could come back 200 years ago in England, that would be cool. I'd be a milkmaid, no problem. I don't mean to be facetious, it's a serious topic. The karmic, the whole meaning of the teachings on karma are that we must take the responsibility for the impact of our choices. And so, but the karmic condition, the karmic impact of choosing to end my death, if my life is intolerable, I don't agree that that means that I will descend in my karmic outcome, that I would then suffer further as a result of avoidance of pain.
And the other side of that was, of course, like most of us feel that doctors that are providing that service are doing it out of compassion and out of the belief that they're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. I mean, what Jennifer's saying, I'm repeating that you're saying that most of us realize that doctors who are willing to be involved with this are going to be doing this not out of harm, out of compassion, totally out of compassion. It's the choice of the patient. It isn't the choice of the physician. I think one of my major concerns that we have in our world is the belief, the erroneous, I believe, belief that dying, illness, pain, suffering is a problem. There's something wrong, and we're supposed not to do that. We're supposed to be alive and healthy and happy forever. Like I was, the statements of the Buddha are, this is our nature, this is going to happen. And to, like, there were many suicides. During the teachings of the Buddha, there are records of so many suicides, people becoming so detached that they were just like, what's the point of staying alive? I can't think that that's any more karmically beneficial when the Buddha's there himself than for us to, when our life is becoming intolerable. We're not supposed to be 80 and 90 and 100 and 110. 80 maybe. I mean, you know, like it's like we're past the best buy date, for goodness sake, you know, so let's just allow it to deteriorate. It's inevitable. It's not a problem. It's not wrong. There isn't a mistake. It's what happens. I think the mistake, personally, I can get heated about this, is staying alive, is making people stay alive. I wouldn't. An agreement I made with my very best friend long, long ago, 20 years ago, not to keep me alive.
TNR.
That, I think, is far more karmically problematic, you know, than not. That's my opinion. My opinion, not based on being a Buddhist scholar.
Sure.
Please.
Yes, I was taken by that as well. Because I had helped someone. Mm-hmm. And I immediately felt, oh, wow, that sounds serious. Because I had gone and talked to the dying thing. So my memory is that he said it wasn't karmically problem.
Ah, that's what that was his concern, was helping someone.
Yeah, it was more like karmically not good if you help someone.
Hmm. If you help someone help themselves. I mean, the point of this particular, what we have made, medical assistance, is helping someone help themselves because we don't have access. I think we should all have access, basically. And then you don't have to imply and implicate anybody else. That's personally what I think. Thank you for bringing it up, Jennifer. That put a damper on the conversation.
You mentioned the precepts.
Yes.
And did you say before you teach, you say the precepts? Can you tell me what the precepts?
Yes, the precepts, the refuges and precepts, they're the sort of traditional practices of Buddhist practitioners. So the precepts are five agreements for lay people. It's kind of like the primary five, but then there are many more. The more monastic you are, the more orders you take, the more guidelines there are to agree to live within. But the first five, which are accessible for everybody, are we did them in the beginning yesterday morning. They are first, sort of the most umbrella of them all is the first one, which is to respect all forms of life, including presumably if we're a doctor and somebody's wanting to die. It's like not taking any life for granted, not harming or killing anyone or anything, any creature, bugs, the whole thing. Respecting all forms of life. You can interpret it in incredibly broad and many different ways. The second one is not stealing, basically. These are agreements to live as best we can without doing these things. It sounds negative, but it's much easier to give yourself a boundary than it is to say, I will be completely content with everything all the time. It's easier to say, I'm not going to steal anything from anyone else or take something that wasn't actually given to me. It's easier to live by than a sort of general idealistic principle. That's why he does it in terms of negation rather than in positive. So not to steal, not to take what's not been given to you. And I love the interpretation of, it's not just things. It's not just steal from shopkeepers, you know. It's steal energy. It's steal attention. It's, you know, convince somebody of something that's not true so that they like you when, you know, and all that. There's a lot you can do with that second one. Third one is sexual energy, and it's not using our sexuality in any way that causes any kind of harm. You know, if you're a monastic, it's celibacy utterly. But if you're a lay person, it's like interpreting that to be, it's, you know, not including energetically, including, you know, like some of the stuff that's available on the internet apparently, and so on and so forth. It's not using our sexual energy inappropriately in any way to harm or cause distress for anyone around any of it. Vows breaking and all this deception. That's the third. The fourth is to speak truly, not to lie. In the negation, it's not to lie. That can itself be interpreted very broadly, not to make an implication, not to spin something with a certain twist against somebody, for instance, you know, in gossip. And the fifth one came much later in the development of the guidelines for living, presumably after they found some drunk monks. And so it's like no intoxications. And then there are three more, which are when people do long retreats, some people take these three more. Not to sleep on high and lofty beds. And some people say that's because there's a woman in it and it's all soft and comfy. But, you know, or you're on top of somebody, you know, like that's what, but who knows what that actually meant. But it meant not to, you know, indulge great comfort in sleep. Not to adorn oneself, and that includes makeup and jewelry and all the rest of it. And not to eat after noon. And so those are considered the eight precepts. Well, on retreat, most people aren't putting on their lipstick and they're not, you know, sleeping on, you know, they just sleep in the bed they're given, which is an average sort of bed, but they don't eat afternoon. And that allows you more freedom to meditate longer with less of drowsiness, basically. And so those are the eight. But three are those, the first five are those common ones, and they're to live by, really, not just to meditate by. But when we do them together in a group, it does create a sense of, okay, we're all being as careful as we can with our energy, and so we can be quiet and sit close together and have some sense of safety, which is huge in the silence among strangers. Yeah. Hi, Marie. What are the other two nuns? There's something that I don't like about them, and so I've put it under my consciousness. It's about second class citizenship when it comes to like lineups and, you know, authority figures, and it's the male female. Yeah. It's about that there are these there is a group of nuns who I'm not good at this. I'm not familiar enough, but who are, there's an order of them. I can't remember their name. Who are Thai practitioners, and they have been accorded a certain amount of acknowledgement in being sort of free to roam and travel in Thailand, because they're otherwise not allowed out of the monasteries. So they're called 10 precept nuns, and they wear brown robes. And I don't even know what that means, but it's about, and it's an issue because, of course, it's the anti-feminine, you know, anti, yes, misogynistic. Whoa, thank you, Lorna. I mean, the Buddha actually, the primary thing the Buddha said about love, usually love would mean not just carnal love, but attached love, relationship type love. And I mean, his primary advice for people to really develop their inner lives is to leave all of that behind and go and sit under a tree and cross your legs and meditate. And however, when he's teaching lay folk and he's teaching people who are householders, he talks about reverence, he talks about respect, he talks about the precepts, he talks about treating everyone, including our near and dear ones. with reverence and, you know, not abusing in any way. Does he say about love? He doesn't. He talks about the state of the mind. He talks about the danger of attachment. He talks about when we like something and we become obsessed about it or attached to it, how we are then consumed in having to have it, and how that is the loss of our clarity and loss of our mindfulness, and be wary, you know. So it's really an interesting practice about being with the things that you value and honor and appreciate without having to have them. Without suddenly the clutch coming in. It's the same as the opposite, being with the things which are challenging and difficult without aversion coming in or resistance or blame. And that's a lot of what he teaches about, how to actually be in the world without being caught with greed, hatred, and delusion. Delusion is misseeing as well as not seeing. Seeing that things are, we need this thing because it's lovely, like this person. When it's actually not true, we're fine without that person. We just have developed an attachment unnecessarily. So he talks a lot about main thrust of his teachings are not falling into greed, desire, attachment, while being able to enjoy and like, and not falling into aversive behaviors when we're confronted with the challenging and difficult and painful. So his love itself, he doesn't use so much love. What he then talks about love is when he goes into metta, the whole teachings he has on metta, loving kindness to all the whole world. But it's so impersonal. It's not personal. It's not personalized relationships of love. It's about caring for humans, being compassionate and enjoying and appreciating in beings, living, all living beings, not just human beings. I don't know if that's useful. Thank you, Lorna. Okay, so time's going by. One thing I'd like us to do, and I always like to do this, we will do it briefly, but it's important to do. In one of the groups that I was with you, two people, and then another one joined and said, I'd like to do that too, wanted to talk a little further about dealing with, in their lives, the topic of dementia, people in their lives. And so I said, why don't you have that conversation towards the end of the retreat, rather than now and here and in the group. And so I'm wondering if there are, what I really think is useful, not just I think is useful, I'm sure is necessary for meditators, is to have friendship, meditating friends, to have a sangha, to be in touch with. And this is a great venue, and there are all these retreats offered, and people come together. But people outside of this venue need to have ongoing friendliness and little sanghas, sitting groups, and things like that. So I really like there to be a bit of time for some conversation with when you've been sitting here all weekend with total strangers, to connect with people. A lot of you are friends with each other and have such friends, and especially the newer folk, you won't necessarily know anybody or many. And so one thing you might want to do is join. And I think only in groups of 5-6 max, because there isn't more than 10 or 15 minutes to actually have a conversation. It's pointless. So smallish groups get together. One group might want to be people who are interested in talking about dementia and dealing with that. I know there are already 3 of you. Do you want to put your hands up? You. And there may be some other people feel like joining these 3. And let's bring you all to this area, and you can have a conversation here with Louise and talk about that. But are there another area of something that people would like to talk to other people about? Sorry? climate change and action, that could be a big long discussion, should be whole retreats on these things, which is hugely important. But yes, anyone really want to, in 10 minutes, have a quick conversation with others who are concerned about that. So you've put your hand up. Karen, anybody else want to join her? Okay, there's one other person. Anyway, you can get together. A thought that I had would be people, for instance, in neighborhoods. Like, you know, are there others who are practitioners who are in the Mbachosin Souk part of the world, or North Saanich, or that might be an interesting gathering too. But if you don't want to do that, just get together with a few people and have a few minutes talking about your retreat and what it's like, and how have you been, and how are you feeling, and what about this energy body thing or something. Any suggestions? Sheena? So I want you to stand up and make a circle. Stand up and make a circle. Making a circle, standing in a circle. Yeah, come into a circle, you two. Yeah. There we go. So first, let's just see each other. We've been here together for the weekend and sort of avoiding seeing each other. Now we can see each other. And you remember yesterday at the end of the day, I suggested that we realize that when we practice quiet, calming, getting a little closer to what's important, what matters, We change energetically, we've changed. And so this is true today too, this weekend. Which means that the way we're going to relate in our life to our people out there in the next period of time will be somewhat transformed. So what would we wish from this weekend when we have another encounter with somebody who wasn't here? May that encounter be a little more delightful. Present.
Kind.
Hmm?
Kind.
Connected.
Calm.
Authentic. Authentic. I'm repeating them for those who can't hear.
Can't hear.
Authentic. Respectful. Cherishing. Oh, I love that word.
Generous.
Honest.
Clear.
Compassionate.
Joyful.
Exactly, joyful. I thought someone was going to get there. I was going to say fun. Aren't these beautiful? May there be, because of our weekend together, more of this in our world. And therefore there would be less miscommunication, judgment, alienation, dismissing, you know, all the biases. May our weekend together, our weekend retreat, be a little more helpful. Our world needs this. It's always needed it, and it needs it even the more now. You know, we need centeredness, we need truthfulness, we need all these beautiful things. So may this have served that somewhat this weekend. So I'm not just saying the words, let's really mean that. I'm speaking for you. Good. That was a good thing then. I want to say thank you to, I want to say, where's Sheena? Sheena, thank you so much for taking care of us. And with her, Karen, also taking care of us and taking care of me and taking care of the place. Bruce, where are you? There's Bruce over there. Taking care of our sound system. Louise, helping him. Where's Louise? There you are. Hi, Louise. And who else has done a lot towards this weekend? Bruce, you know who.
Brian was here,
registrar. He left today. He was here yesterday.
And Joel was here to set up.
Right.
He was set up on the tour quite
late. Right. And there's always plenty going on behind the scenes for these things to happen, so much appreciation to all of you. And then mostly I thank you. I thank you for caring, for showing up, being here, being interested. It's not fun and easy sometimes. It's boring or embarrassing or... But thank you for caring. Thank you for listening to me. Thank you for being responsive. And I thank my teachers and their teachers. And I thank years of practitioners who don't speak something that there's not something out there that you get. It's something in here that comes out. And so that helps other people and keeps us all going. So thank you to the Buddha who began this particular form of teaching. So those are my thank yous.